Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe to Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. This week we are back in Tajikistan, where signs are that the economy is in a bad shape. The country is increasingly sliding towards China's economic sphere of influence. Nepotism, corruption, and all the other signs of authoritarian tendencies are on the rise. But authorities seem not very much bothered by this situation, and those who think differently find themselves in jail, mostly together with their lawyers. In other words, as per the authorities, there is one solution to all problems: put them in jail. Today on the Majlis, Ready for Europe, Do Liberty, Central Asia podcast, we have a couple of very simple questions: that how long can this situation last? What are the signs on where things are headed from here, and what are the possible way out for Tajikistan? To discuss all these, I am joined by Kate Barth, Legal Director of Freedom Now, an organization working to protect human rights. Michael Anderson is joining us, who is the journalist and documentary filmmaker specializing in Central Asia. And Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. So the other day, I saw a picture of a 4-year-old kid from Tajikistan who's struggling with cancer, is in need of proper treatment, but he's not allowed to leave the country. The reason, he's the grandson of one of the members of banned Islamic Party. I think authorities also have some interpretation as to what's going on here. But the heartbreaking story is this, that even a 4-year-old kid is not immune to this ongoing repression. So, Bruce, tell us what else has been happening in Tajikistan lately since we visited this country a couple of weeks ago on the Majlis.
First, it's worth mentioning that the child that you just referred to is Mukhadin Kabiri's grandson. And, of course, he is the leader of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. Yeah. But the example of not letting him out of the country is just builds on this practice that the Tajik authorities have of collective punishment. Even if you're related to somebody that they have some grievance with, you know, they'll go after the family. A lot of people have left the country so that they're not thrown in jail. Mukhadin Kabiri is one of them, and so the authorities not able to get a hold of him and detain him are instead, you know, taking this out on a poor 4-year-old boy who really is in need of medical treatment soon. This has been a pattern that's been increasing in Tajikistan in recent years. But, you know, just this month alone, besides Kabiri's grandson, we saw the journalist and Michael's friend, Hayrullo Mirsaidov, who has been held since late last year for just writing a report about local corruption, you know, and hoping that it might spur authorities to take some action against this stuff. He's a well-known figure not only for being a journalist, but he's also with this comedy team that from this program that dates back to the Soviet era. And all of a sudden, the charges came up against him, and they sentenced him with, you know, flimsy evidence to 12 years in jail. So that was one thing. And then there's another figure, Zaid Saidov. 2013, he decided he was going to create a new political party in Tajikistan. He had been a government official before. In fact, he was a sort of official at the time. I think he was in charge of the table tennis team or something like that. But it was still a state position. But he declared that he was going to form this new party, Tajikistani Now. And as soon as he announced that he was going to do that, and he announced at the same time he had no intention of running for president, it didn't matter. You know, the Tajik authorities went into overdrive. There were charges against him that ranged all over the place, from corruption, you know, anti-constitutional activities to simple things of, you know, to more, I suppose you'd call them odious crimes of like, you know, polygamy and statutory rape. You know, I mean, there was all kinds of charges they put against him, and they put him in jail. And the UN Rights Committee earlier this month, you know, released a statement saying that they found the charges against him unconvincing and the trial process was flawed, and they called for him to be released, at which point the Tajik government simply said it's an internal affair and we don't have to respect the decision of the UN body on this one.
Yeah, definitely we are going to talk about that. Kate, who's on our panel today, was one of the persons working to make this happen at UN. So before that, Michael, if I could invite you to talk a little bit about your friend that Bruce also mentioned, Khairullah Mirsaidov. He appears to be one of the recent victims. So tell us about him. As I understand, you had an opportunity to work with him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm very proud to call him my friend and my colleague over, yeah, more than 15 years. We work very, very close together on numerous media projects all over Central Asia, not just in Tajikistan. And, you know, to be honest, I feel like I want to channel, so to speak, Harlo when I hear the talk about the terrible case with the four-year-old who can't get out of Tajikistan because he happens to be related to somebody the president hates. You know, this is where Harlo Mirzayedov would stand up and say, guys, let's remember, no disrespect to this four-year-old who is in a terrible, terrible situation, which is disgusting. But there are tens of thousands of other Tajik who are in similar situations for one reason and one reason only, that the president is a crook. The people around him have stolen the country, stolen the wealth and the money which is in the country. And that's why they can't get proper treatment in the country. Hmm. You know, people from Denmark or Sweden don't have to go to other countries to get treated for cancer because we have a democracy that respects the people who pay the tax. This doesn't happen in Tajikistan. And that's what Hayrullo Mirzayedov was saying. And that's what is Hayrullo's role in Tajikistan. That's what he's been doing for 20 years, writing about people who don't have a voice, as we say. He's been giving them a voice. He's been talking to people, you know, with AIDS. He's been talking to prostitutes, to people who have been unfairly accused of all sorts of things, who have been tortured and beaten up by the corrupt police. And that's what makes Hayrullo very popular in Tajikistan, quite well known. And it's also why we from the West should speak up for people like that. It is only if we support people like Hayrullo that we have any hope of Tajikistan moving in a democratic direction.
Right, right. Okay, Kate, let me bring you in here. You are representing a couple of victims. Muhammad Ali Haidt is one of them. Zayed Saidov, as Bruce was referring earlier, is one of them. And Buzurg Meher Yorup is also among the people that you are working on behalf of them. So tell us about those cases. What's going on with them?
Yeah, absolutely. I do just want to make one point about the case of Mirzayedov before discussing those other prisoners of conscience. Mirzayedov, is his conviction 2 weeks ago really kind of represents a new low in the country, because effectively what he was imprisoned for was basically being a whistleblower on local corruption. And up until that point, most of the people that we've seen being imprisoned are people like Mohammad Ali Haidt or Zayed Saidov, who are political opposition figures or their lawyers. The fact that Mirzayedov, who is not directly criticizing President Rahman himself, is not a political opposition figure, just really shows that we've kind of hit this new level of low where absolutely no criticism of any government official anywhere is going to be permitted. And I think that's very disturbing. I mean, obviously, it's also very disturbing, you know, that the government has spent the last several years taking out all of the opposition figures, like Mohammad Ali Haidt and the other, I think it was 13 IRPT members that were tried and sentenced along with him, all of them to extremely long sentences. Mr. Haidt himself, or Haidt himself, was convicted to life. And we had filed a petition on Mr. Haidt's behalf with the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which is a group of experts that sits at the UN level and is basically empowered to make a kind of quasi-judicial determination as to whether or not individuals have, in fact, been detained arbitrarily and in violation of international law. And a few months ago, the working group did come back and said, yes, Tajikistan, in fact, has violated international law in several ways. First of all, there was absolutely no basis for his arrest. Secondly, he was arrested solely because he was exercising his fundamental right to freedom of speech, to freedom of association, and to freedom to participate in political affairs. And finally, as I think, you know, everyone on this podcast and hopefully many of our listeners are aware, that the court systems in Tajikistan, which are convicting these government critics, they're basically kangaroo courts, and there's really no due process. So that was a decision that came down a couple of months ago on Mr. Haidt's case. Just 2 weeks ago, the UN Human Rights Committee, which is another body of the UN that oversees the implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, issued a very similar decision on the case of Mr. Saidov. Again, basically saying that the government of Tajikistan had violated international law, specifically that it had violated its freely undertaken treaty obligations under the ICCPR in detaining him because he had exercised his freedom of expression and freedom of association in announcing this new political party.
Just to continue, Kate, with you, since you've been studying these cases, so what is the kind of a common feature between the people that you are representing in terms of their background and the path leading to this this trouble?
Well, everyone that we represent, whether it's a political leader or, you know, one of the very brave human rights lawyers like Berzhigmir Yurov, who represented them, they've never advocated for violence. These are people who really are just courageous and peaceful and are trying to do what they can to work towards sort of a more democratic and human rights respecting Tajikistan. As was mentioned by Bruce earlier, Tajikistan does have this, you know, kind of horrific trend of collective punishment. So a lot of times these people in, you know, speaking out and standing up are not just putting themselves at risk, you know, but they're also really potentially endangering some of their loved ones. And it's just a really difficult position for them to be in. So I would say, I mean, it's really kind of an honor for me to be able to do what I can to assist these people, because they really do strike me as very courageous, kind of modern day heroes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Kate. Michael, a spokesperson of Islamic Revival Party, supposed to join us, but in the last minute he dropped out. In his absence, let me come to you. His party, the Islamic Revival Party, seems to be the biggest victim of this recent crackdown. What would you like to add what Kate was saying and what Bruce has said in this?
I think what they both mentioned about the collective punishment, I mean, this is obviously, you know, something that harks back to Stalinist times. And, you know, we all know that Stalin had this saying, you know, "Нет человека, нет проблемы." If you get rid of the person, you get rid of the problem. And there's two things here. A, that turned out for even Mr. Stalin and the Soviet Union not actually to work. You can't kill everybody in the country. You can have a go at it, but at the end you will fail. And the other thing is, this is what is going on in Tajikistan now. You know, that people stand up and they are arrested, like Khairul Law, like many, many hundreds of other people. And then they get a lawyer, if they can find a lawyer that's courageous enough to stand up and defend them. And this person gets arrested, and so on. We have cases in Tajikistan now where the lawyer of the lawyer of the lawyer is being arrested. I mean, this is bizarre. And what I would like to say when it comes to, for example, people like Mr. Kabiri, is that I don't want to go into, I'm not an expert on this, I don't want to go into, you know, did they do that, did they do this? The fact is that we need to get to a situation in Tajikistan where people can protest, where they can criticize, where they can argue and defend themselves without immediately being either, you know, arrested, beaten up, or have to flee the country, or something that's even worse. And I come back to the fact that the international community needs to react now. I mean, after Mr. Karimov died, there seems to be something of a, I don't want to call it a spring, but some positive signs in Uzbekistan. We should support that. But Mr. Rahmon now seems to be, you know, the heir of Karimov and wants to turn Tajikistan into a second Uzbekistan. The international community knows where this is going if we don't try to do something about it. Yeah. We didn't do anything in Uzbekistan. Let's do something in Tajikistan.
We will get to that, Michael, a little bit later, Bruce. Also, the second opposition party, Group 24, is kind of wiped out in Tajikistan. Its leader, Omar Ali Kuatov, couldn't escape that despite fleeing the country. Earlier, we reported that about his death in Istanbul. So tell us about, is there anyone left at this stage who could claim to be member of either the Islamic Party or the Group 24?
Well, certainly there are people in the country who are members of both groups. Now, whether they would want to actually say that publicly, I doubt it at this point. You know, but unfortunately, that does not stop the Tajik government from going after them at certain moments. We had a case just a couple months ago where four guys, I think, in the north in Tajikistan, were Islamic Renaissance Party members, and they were overheard in restaurants criticizing Tajik government policies. Now, they weren't so much advocating or proselytizing for the IRPT or anything like that, but it was known that they had been members, and now they were criticizing the Tajik government. And so on that basis, they were detained, and I think they still are detained too. So, you know, even if people are willing to not speak out, you know, if they're known members of these groups in the past, but they're being quiet, the government keeps track of them. And every now and then, for reasons which are sometimes unclear and sometimes seem absolutely ridiculous, they decide that they're going to round some of them up and put them in detention. And I imagine this is just to remind, or, you know, to keep up that level of fear all the time, you know, and keep reinforcing the idea that if you dare to speak out against the government, if you dare to criticize someone, you're going to go to jail too. You know, I mean, there are opponents of the government in the country. The Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan had at least 40,000 registered members before it was banned. By some accounts, there was twice that many people in the party. Not all of them got out of the country.
You mentioned this 40,000 registered members of the Islamic Revival Party. So given the situation as such today, how you imagine their day-to-day life might look like these days?
Well, for one thing, your chances are, if they're trying to get some kind of job, good job or something like that, they probably won't get it. Certainly, they wouldn't get a job as a state official. It would be almost impossible that would happen. You know, and we saw the same thing, actually, the same kind of thing happened to lawyers a few years ago, where they defended, before they started throwing them in jail, if they defended opposition figures, that all of a sudden they couldn't find work. No one wanted to hire them anymore. You know, and I imagine it's the same for former members of the Islamic Renaissance Party. Now, of course, this depends on where you were in the party hierarchy. If you were closer to the top, chances are that you are unemployed and you're, you know, these would be somewhat older people. So maybe their children are supporting them, or they're living with a relative or something like that. Maybe they got to keep their house. I don't know. But in any case, their opportunity for work is extremely limited, if it's there at all. They're constantly being surveilled. So the government keep track of what they're doing, and they need only make the slightest error in judgment, in their words, or like I said, or in their actions. And that will be enough for them to at least be invited to the police station and possibly detained, and maybe worse later on.
I think, Kate, you should know this for a fact. The people that you are representing, a couple of them I just mentioned here, could be more than this. So how their family members are treated in Tajikistan?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of their family members are or have been kind of victims of this collective punishment. I mean, a great example is the case of Burzugmir Yurov, whose brother, Jamshed Yurov, was also a lawyer and tried to take on the representation of Burzugmir after he was put in prison. Jamshed himself was then arrested, and after he was released, he fled the country along with his sister, seeking refuge in Europe. The other very troubling trend here is that this repression is actually, the Tajik government has begun to kind of flex its muscles extraterritorially, which is to say the repression is not limited by its borders. And the Tajik government has begun to, you know, harass dissidents who've left or the families of the dissidents who've left through, you know, Interpol red notices, at times we've seen kidnappings from other countries. In the case of Jamshed Yurov, he actually was followed to his refugee camp by a member of the Tajik security forces who he had recognized from, you know, an illegal search of his office a year prior. So unfortunately, I think we're seeing a very dangerous and difficult situation for the family members of our dissidents, again, a lot of whom themselves are extraordinarily brave in continuing to speak out publicly for their imprisoned family member, despite the risk to themselves.
I know, Michael, you want to say something. Just let me recap the debate here. So now this is the heartbreaking reality in Tajikistan. The question is why authorities are doing this, and more importantly, why and how they escape accountability for their actions. We will continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast, we are discussing an evolving human tragedy in Tajikistan and its potential consequences. Joining me in the discussion are Kate Barth, legal director of Freedom Now, Michael Anderson, journalist and documentary filmmaker specializing in Central Asia, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I am Mohammed Tahir, a host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. So, Michael, let's start with you. Rahmon is a president, has a strong and unchallenged hold in power, is running the government together with his daughters and son, and his son-in-law appears to be unchallenged business lord in the country with most of the profitable business in his control. But why is President Rahmon still doing all these repression?
First and foremost, Mohammed, I'll hold you up as a little bit of a joke, but not just a joke. Rahmon is not a president, he's a dictator. I think we should probably, as journalists and experts, starting using the correct terms. A president is what we have, you know, what you have even in the United States or in France and so on. Rahmon is not chosen by the people. That's a different thing. But that's beside the point here. What Rahmon is doing is also, Bruce mentioned people being chucked into detention and prisons and stuff like that because Rahmon wants to get rid of opposition and criticism. That's I would say by now, because he's been in power for so many years, that's only half of what he's doing. The other half is that this is a business. Rahmon allows local police in Hujan and Horog everywhere to harass people, to threaten people, beat up people, throw them into prisons, also because this is a great business. What happens in a country like Tajikistan, or Uzbekistan for that matter, when you are put into prison or under arrest, accused of being an Islamic terrorist, the worst of the worst accusation, is that the police will keep you in, they'll beat you up, they'll get you to some kind of confession, and then they'll approach your family saying, well, you know, this man can get out if there's a straf, a fine pay, or some kind of bribe. This happens all the time. I've heard about dozens and dozens and dozens of these cases. So this is business. This is why, one of the reasons why Rahmon keeps doing this. Mm-hmm. The longer you're in power as a dictator, the more mouth need to feed, the more people are waiting for you to, you know, let the wealth you have stolen come down into the society, into the small towns, into the small villages. That's one of the reasons he's still doing it, because he has to do it. He is also depending on you know, the people who arrested Harul Omizidov in Hujan and all the other cases.
Wow, it's a sad story. Bruce, so looking into the roots of this repression, the way that Michael was explaining, one has to be a psychologist to understand it, but is there any political explanation as to his activities, especially in regard to continued repression of opposition, civil society, etc.? These actions are taken in repressive countries when the leader feels threatened. By given his absolute grip in power, he has every power he needs. So then what is crackdown all about?
Well, if we are willing to concede that he has absolute power now, it needs to be said that he has not for most of, in my opinion anyway, for most of the time he's actually been president of the country. Certainly in the 1990s during the Civil War era, his hold on power was shaky at best. The joke, even when I was in Central Asia and, you know, in the mid-1990s, was when people would refer to Rahmon, they called him the mayor of Dushanbe because his authority didn't extend any further than the city limits. So, you know, this wasn't something like he's always been the iron-fisted despot that people portray him as, you know. And part of the peace deal was that he had to share power with the opposition, mainly with the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, but there are other opposition groups in the country too. And so he had rivals that he had to watch out for from the opposition, but also the people that supported him during the civil war years that were part of the government were also potentially rivals to him. And I think of Mahmoud Saeed Ubaydullayev, who is still the chairman of the Senate, and until a couple years ago was the mayor of Dushanbe, and a lot of people used to say that you know, he told Rahmon what he should do, and if Rahmon didn't accept what he wanted, then he would even possibly hit him in the head or something. So there was a lot of people that, at least in Rahmon's mind, I think, he felt that could topple him if they wanted to. Now, he has systematically gotten rid of any of these people, or certainly neutralized them to the point where they are no longer a threat to him. I would say it's only really been in the last couple of years that you could say that he is the absolute authority in the country. There still might be people who are capable of getting rid of him. I don't see them anymore. But like I said, this is relative to his term in power. This is a more recent development where he has carte blanche to pretty much do what he wants. But, you know, it hasn't, I think that sense of paranoia that's been with him for most of his tenure is still with him. And he just doesn't want to hear any criticism about the way he's running the country or hear anything that might sound like a potential rival coming.
So let me ask this, Bruce. So what can possibly convince him to stop?
Well, you'd have to cut off his money flow, for one thing. I mean, let's face it, Tajikistan has been donor dependent practically since day one, and it's still largely dependent. A lot of the money that comes in comes from remittances from migrant laborers, mainly in Russia. he benefits from the fact that, that Tajikistan has a unique geostrategic location, geopolitical strategic location. He's by Afghanistan, but he is also, he's bordering China, and he's got a Russian military presence in his country too. Now, Russia and China don't want to see him go down because they think that, that problems from Afghanistan would spill over the border, and that both Russia or China could be contaminated by militants that come into Tajikistan. So they're willing to prop him up, and you know, he wasn't ally in the war on terror with the U.S. post 9/11, and you know, he still does get some help from the U.S. and from the European Union. So he's kind of in a, for him, I suppose, in a pretty convenient situation and position, because no one wants to see his government fall and let chaos break out in Tajikistan, even though certainly in the West they know that he's, you know, he is a despot and he's an authoritarian leader and he's stealing all kinds of money from the country, him and his family. But there's no viable alternative that we can see at the moment for a replacement for him, because of course he's chased everyone out of the country who was a, you know, a really potentially a qualified leader. So, you know, it's a horrible situation. But you're kind of, I think a lot of countries think we're stuck with him because they're afraid of what happens if they don't have him.
Well, Michael, it's kind of reaching to, a, as Bruce was saying, a paranoia stage. But the consequences of his actions are so tragic. I can't forget this kid's image who's not allowed to leave the country for treatment earlier this week. So it's not to defend Rahmon's repression and policies. But is there any role that opposition might be playing in this tragedy?
You mean in the crackdown?
I mean, in provoking him or any other way?
Yes, of course they're provoking him. They are criticizing him and saying their opinion. If that could be called provoking. No, I'm joking. Of course, I don't see. I mean, I've done a couple of films about this myth of extremism, and ironically, one of the main people we interviewed for this film was Kabiri, and he gave me one of the best and most calm analysis. This was when he was still living in Tajikistan about 7-8 years ago. He gave me one of the best and most calm analysis of this, and he says, well, you know, it was very important that the Islamic Renaissance Party was given a role in Tajikistan after the civil war, because we actually work and incorporate, try to invite in some of the young people who could potentially go extremist, to be violent. And of course, Rahmon, I think, runs a risk, and actually the larger international community runs a risk by letting Rahmon run amok in Tajikistan, because at this moment, as Bruce so frighteningly talked about, there is no way that you can even have a little peep of discontent or criticism. You are immediately, you know, hunted down and kicked out from your jobs, or even worse. And I think there is Islamic Renaissance Party previously played the role of a valve for certain people in the Tajik society, where they could go and discuss and maybe be more informed about the role of Islam and you know, in a more peaceful society, not to go the Afghan way. And I think all the Central Asian countries at this moment seriously run the risk of driving thousands of people in a more extreme direction.
Okay, we are now talking about on how to avoid this tragedy. In this, I want to draw your attention to the letter that you and a couple of other organizations has written recently to European Union's foreign policy chiefs. So what are you expecting to come out of this?
Well, you know, I fully share Michael's belief that it's crucial for the international community to be doing more, to be speaking up loudly, to be conditioning closer bilateral relations with the government of Tajikistan on measurable kind of human rights advances. And I do know that the EU and the US in particular, you know, are not comfortable with what's going on in Tajikistan. It's also perhaps worth noting that, in fact, there have already been some negative consequences to Tajikistan for this behavior. For example, Tajikistan, you know, would love to be given GSP plus status, which basically would exempt them from some tariffs for the EU. Unfortunately, that for Tajikistan, that status is conditioned on, you know, human rights advances. They haven't been able to get that. Tajikistan would also love to be given a waiver to the Jackson-Vanik Amendment in the U.S., which would, again, allow them greater access here as well. That waiver has not come because of their human rights situation. So one of the things that, you know, my organization, as well as some of the other NGOs that we're working with, are really hoping to do with that letter, as well with our work generally, is to push governments of rights-respecting states into taking a harsher line with Tajikistan, to making sure that they're bringing up these cases, you know, in every conversation that they're having with their Tajik counterparts, as well as, you know, using the sticks that they have in their possession. Here in the U.S., there's the Global Magnitsky Act, which would allow listed Tajik officials who, you know, have basically committed pretty grievous human rights abuses to have their assets frozen. There'd also be a travel ban put on them. So we're hoping that, you know, the U.S. government will include some Tajik names on that list for the next time around. Basically, because the situation is so bad in Tajikistan right now, it's really crucial that the international community stand up and speak up and, you know, tell Roman that this is not acceptable and that his government is not going to get the benefits of a responsible state while they, you know, maintain this level of crackdown.
Okay. So it's a very important but a sad discussions that we are having today, but unfortunately we have to conclude it. In doing so, let me ask this, Michael. So if there's anyone who can make any difference in this situation, who is that and what can that person, country, or the institution do?
I want to take up what Kate just said about the Magnitsky. I mean, to me, the Magnitsky sanctions, which is targeted sanctions against people who are involved in human rights defenses, I think this is one of the very positive, on a very, very sad background, of course, but one of the few positive, very positive measures that have come up over the last few years. For reasons I don't quite understand, a lot of these crooks, and that goes to, you know, some of the Karimov family previously, the Belarusian dictators, the Kazakh dictators, they have something they don't like about being put on these targeted sanctions lists. They maybe it's because their young wives or their rich daughters want to go shopping in Monte Carlo and London and they visit their houses in Marbella, I don't know. But those targeted sanctions seem to work. We know for a fact that Putin has problems with some of the Russian oligarchs who now have been put on these sanctions lists. So I would say in a small country like Tajikistan, it's very, very easy to find out who is involved in this. I mean, I can tell you the names. You know, it happens to in Khairullah's case, the prosecutor is called Rahmon as a last name. You know, let's go for him. Let's put him on a list. He is clearly involved in something that is an attack on human rights and free media. And we are supposed to defend that from the European Union. So I would like to see people like that put on the list. I think that will make it quite a difference.
Okay, Bruce, final notes from you.
You know, I mean, let's face it. One of these days, Tajikistan's geopolitical importance is going to go away. It won't be important anymore. You know, he's bleeding this country dry and stealing all everything. Rahman, I mean, stealing all the money they got. They are always going to need help from the outside, and help has to be conditioned, severely conditioned, that we are willing to donate projects. We want monitoring of how all the money is spent. And this is not just we're giving you money, but we are going to give you money as we see improvement in the behavior of the government. Now, I'm not suggesting cut them off from things for purified water or anything like that, but there's a lot of infrastructure projects that Tajikistan needs money for, and should, you know, international organizations, financial organizations, governments. And I know this isn't going to work with a lot of governments, but certainly in the West, they should say we're willing to help, but we need to see some moves on your part too. It's easier for us to deal with a partner who shares some of our values than to just give money to a charity case.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlak Uwazi. Also, big thanks goes to Kate Barth, legal director of Freedom Now, Michael Anderson, journalist and documentary filmmaker specializing in Central Asia. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It was very nice to have you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week. Bye-bye.